Welcome to the UK's only weekly FM radio show on transportation. I'm Mark Ovenden. Today we're talking with one of Britain's leading historians and a hugely respected and influential professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies. Welcome to the Catchcast, Dafydd Fell.
It's a pleasure to be on the show and I've enjoyed a lot of the early episodes.
Oh, well, thank you very much for listening and thanks for joining us. And we're going to discuss your amazing book on industrial railways very, very soon. But I seem to start all my interviews by asking every guest on the show a very similar first question, and that is, how and when did you originally get interested in things like transport and infrastructure?
Well, I guess I'm from a kind of transport family. My father, Russell Fell, who's published books on buses and spent most of his life photographing buses, so that was one factor. And I guess I also grew up as a train spotter, and then I made a transition from train spotting to traveling around the UK on those kind of rail rovers. I think another factor was living in China for a couple of years as a child, where our parents were teaching in a university in China. And that allowed us to travel around much of China in the early 1980s. So a kind of a range of kind of factors really got me into railways and transport.
Wow, that is an amazing admission there. You spent a couple of years growing up in China. Roughly when about was this then, David?
So that was 1981 to 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was a time when China still had regular steam engines running on regular passenger services. So that was exciting. And the fact that our parents all around the country in the summer and winter holidays.
Crikey, that really must have been a very formative time for your life then, to see steam trains buzzing around in the 1980s. A very lucky man, I think.
Yeah, I would say so, because, I mean, growing up in the 80s in the UK, you kind of think about steam railways as being that kind of almost like ancient history, because I was born in 1970, so quite a few years after the kind of the demise of steam in Britain.
And what about your early college or university life? What did you study?
So I think because of that experience of living in China at kind of primary school age, I tried to keep up my Chinese after I came back. So I ended up doing a degree in modern Chinese studies at University of Leeds. And that should have meant having a year in studying in China. But because that clashed with the Tiananmen incident, when there was a big violent crackdown on student protesters in China, I ended up switching to a year in Taiwan. So that meant that I kind of got to learn Chinese in another Chinese-speaking country.
And there aren't that many of them, so I think you did quite well there, didn't you, really?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really transformative year for me, because I arrived in Taiwan as a 19-year-old, knowing almost nothing about the place, speaking with a mainland Chinese accent, and just discovering what an amazing and fascinating place Taiwan was.
Well, we're going to definitely knuckle down and find out more about your life there. But then after your studies, I believe you got taken on as staff. Tell me about what happened, how you got into work then.
So after I graduated from Leeds, then I spent 7 years working in Taiwan, mainly as a language school teacher. I did a few other things, like I had a radio show. I worked as a translator. And during that period of time, I was trying to think about what should I do next. And I ended up becoming interested in Taiwanese politics and came back to the UK in 1999, started a PhD in politics at SOAS, University of London, and I've managed to stay there since. At SOAS, I teach in the politics department and I run a Taiwan research centre there, which I've run now for, 23 years.
I'm going to have to jump in here. You did a radio show in Taiwan. What was it in Chinese?
We did an English language show at a station called Kaohsiung Broadcasting Station. And we did a kind of a mix of local news and music. I did that for a couple of years. I think it would have been 1999. And then when I came back for a year in 2001. So it was a really nice and nice experience.
Wow. I didn't realise we were going to end up speaking to a fellow radio presenter. So congratulations on that. You've contributed to so many areas of study, I can see on your university page. Just give us a little introduction to some of the many, many papers and specialist subjects that you've covered.
So my research tends to focus on Taiwanese electoral and party politics. So, for example, in 2001, I had a book on Taiwan's green parties, kind of tracking the 25 years of the party's history. And I have a Chinese version of that book that just came out a couple of weeks ago. My first book also looked at party politics in Taiwan more kind of broadly, looking at party politics in its first decade of multi-party politics in the 1990s. And I'm really lucky to be working at a university where I can actually teach about Taiwan and Taiwan's politics, because it's a real, SOAS is a really unique kind of specialist university. So that's what's kept me there for 20 plus years.
Yeah, I was lucky to come across SOAS myself when I was a kid, because I think one of my aunties used to work in one of the libraries there, and they were clearing things out and they took down a whole load of very sort of antiquated old shelving, and we ended up with it in our house. And I used to build my model TV studios out of Lego and place them on old shelves that used to be in the SOAS library.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I mean, even when I was studying at Leeds, I would often come down to London to use the SOAS library, because it's such a kind of treasure trove of resources.
We're very lucky to have that university here, and we're so lucky to have someone like yourself working there. You mentioned your studies in Leeds, and you were obviously looking in detail in Chinese. How did you get so interested? And tell us a little bit about the wonderful characters that form the Chinese language.
So there's a kind of a family connection here, that my father studied Chinese at Leeds as well, but he could never get to China because of the Cultural Revolution. So that eventually he got to China in the early 1980s, together bringing his family there. So that was how I first kind of had that contact with the Chinese language. And you're right, it is quite a tricky language to, particularly writing Chinese, takes a lot of practice and discipline. That's something that you really need endless practice. The actual grammar of Chinese, I think, is relatively straightforward, much simpler than a European language. Of course, the writing in Taiwan, the characters are much more complex. They use a more traditional style of characters, so it takes even more practice and dedication.
I suppose it's one false stroke as you're trying to draw those beautiful letters and you're meaning something completely different.
Actually, I would say that it's easier to get confusion in the speaking, because often the speaking, if you get the tone wrong, that could lead to a different meaning. I think the characters, once you recognize them, it makes reading relatively fast. And of course, nowadays we can type Chinese, which is much quicker than that kind of than handwriting.
Wow, it is absolutely fascinating language. Your specialism is in the Southeast Asian island of Taiwan. And maybe could you first describe your own interest in that wonderful place, other than having spent a bit of time there? Why is it so fascinating?
Well, I arrived in Taiwan at a time that Taiwan was changing quite rapidly. Mm-hmm. So it was changing from being an authoritarian society into a kind of vibrant democracy. So I think that's one of the things that really excited me. I was there in 1989 when there was 1990, when there were big student protests, and Taiwan then put itself on a track towards multi-party democracy within that 1 year. So while in China they cracked down on student protests, in the Taiwan case, roughly at the same time, the president talks to the students and then sets out a blueprint for democratization. So to me, Taiwan is just such a fascinating place, a place that I keep returning to even after I move back to the UK. I think there's so many things that make this country special. Currently, we often hear a lot about its role in the semiconductor industry, for example. But socially, I think it's a really fascinating place. For example, the first country in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage. Mm. It has the highest proportion of female parliamentarians in East Asia. And in terms of gender equality, it's often seen as being the real pioneer in Asia. And from the perspective of railways and transport, it is also a fascinating place with so much interesting things to see. For example, the Alishan Mountain Railway attracts a lot of attention that goes from basically sea level up into the high mountains, because of course so much of Taiwan is mountainous and the amount of flat plain is quite limited.
Yes, I was going to ask if you could sort of paint a picture for us about what the island is like. I mean, how big it is and how it came to be what it is. I think it originally used to be known as Formosa, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, in terms of size, as a Welsh person, it's nice to think about Taiwan as being similar to the size of Wales. Mm-hmm. In the approximately 100-150 kilometres away from the Chinese coast. It's a very mountainous island that has a big effect on things like railway engineering. It's a country that's gone through multiple phases of colonization with the Dutch and the Spanish in the 17th century, and then a long period of Chinese colonization. And then in 1895, it becomes Japan's first overseas colony following the First Sino-Japanese War. And that has a real transformative effect on the island. I think it's one of the things that has made Taiwan quite different from the rest of China, that experience of colonization and having a very different historical memory to that of the rest of China in the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, that certainly must shape things, mustn't it, when you've been sort of taken over by multiple different countries?
Yes, I think so. And each colonizer leaves a different set of legacies. And of course, we can even say that Taiwan is then recolonized by the Republic of China after the end of the Japanese colonial era in 1945.
Yes, because I was going to say, if it was a Japanese colony, how come they basically speak a form of Chinese?
If we go back in history, Taiwan is populated by a set of Austronesian peoples. And Chinese only start to arrive on Taiwan in large numbers, permanently, in the 17th century, during the Dutch colonial era. So gradually, over the next 300 years, the proportion of Han Chinese on the island increases. So that today, the Austronesian population only makes up about 2.5% of the population, while well over 90% are Han Chinese.
Right, okay, that gives us a bit of background. And you mentioned the role of some of the colonies. I believe it was the Dutch East India Company were very big there. And was that because they saw the potential? Again, you mentioned the physical geography of the place. You've got these kind of quite narrow strips of agricultural land, I suppose, and then the big mountainous areas. Tell us a little bit about how the sugar industry began on those plains.
So the sugar industry as a modern industry really only starts to develop after the arrival of the Japanese in 1895.
Ah.
Prior to that, there was sugar production, but it was very, very primitive. And they start developing irrigation systems and sugar railways, as well as the national railway, very soon after they take over the island in 1895. So, for example, we have the first modern sugar refinery is established in southern Taiwan in 1901. And by the mid-1930s, there's something like 45 modern sugar mills on the island. And these are supplied by these sugar cane railways that were using a 762 millimeter gauge track. And this network of railways is, at the end of the Japanese colonial era, is extremely dense. So by the time the Japanese leave, there's something like 3,500 kilometers of sugar railway track supplying cane to these sugar refineries. We were at the end of the Japanese colonial era with these 3,000 plus kilometers of 762 millimeter gauge sugar railways.
Mm.
And to a certain extent, these sugar railways fit our kind of stereotype of what an industrial railway should do. In other words, local sugar traffic to the mill. But even in that era, there were some exceptions to that kind of stereotypical image of an industrial railway, because as early as 1909, the sugar companies started to have passenger lines So it meant that there was something like, I think, about 400 kilometers of passenger routes, but again, by the end of the Japanese colonial era. And that would actually expand after 1945, when Taiwan becomes a province of the Republic of China, after the Japanese are defeated in the end of the Second World War. And one of the consequences of that changing ruling power was that what were previously four or five large private Japanese companies running the sugar industry, it was nationalized into a single company called Taiwan Sugar Corporation. So that changed that sector quite radically. So because they became a single company, they started to connect these formerly isolated railway systems through major bridges and connecting lines. So over a period of about 6 or 7 years, these isolated systems were connected to a kind of connected system of over 3,000 kilometers.
Wow.
And this also meant that for the first time, they could actually move the sugar from the mills to the harbor. And during this era, sugar became Taiwan's number one export, basically in the 1950s and 1960s. Something like 70 to 80% of Taiwan's sugar in this period of very rapid economic growth was carried by these sugar trains. So they were traveling quite long distances, often journeys of 8 or 9 hours from the central Taiwan to the harbor in the south, in a place called Kaohsiung. So again, this contradicts our image of short, localized industrial railways with a kind of an interconnected, almost like nationwide network. And I think another thing that made this system really interesting was how diverse the cargo was. So it wasn't just sugar. They carried sugar byproducts such as molasses and bagasse for paper production. They carried crude oil, again, from the oil fields to the refinery. They carried bananas, seafood. These were all things that we discovered when we were doing this research for our book, The Twilight Years of Taiwan's Sugar Railways, just how unique this railway system was.
So very quickly after nationalisation, they improved massively and it became the real heyday of the railway system. What were the reasons for its start of its decline?
Well, the first part that starts to decline is the passenger services. They actually had their heyday in the 1950s through to the mid-1960s. And they actually expand on the and create some new routes after 1945 with modern express passenger services carrying about 10% of the rail passengers at their peak. But they start to face competition from buses and motorcycles. So the very large-scale closure of passenger routes in the 1970s and the final passenger line closes in 1982. The freight was able to be more competitive, and through until the late 1980s. So by the time I arrive in Taiwan and start photographing in 1994, the network is still pretty significant. There's about 1,500 kilometers of track, and there's still quite diverse cargo. So I was still able to see the last year of trains carrying salt, and we still had molasses tanker trains, filtered mud trains, cane trains, sugar sack van trains. So when I started photographing, I was just really hooked on these really diverse sugar trains that were often going on quite long distance journeys.
So you started taking these photographs, as you say, in the 1990s, and you must have built up quite a big stash of all these things. What made you decide to turn all this into some kind of a book?
Yes, well, so I took the photographs between 1994 and 1999, and then I went into my kind of academic life and kind of set it aside. And then probably about 10 years ago, I was kind of noticing the way there seemed to be growing interest within Taiwan about Taiwan's railway history. So it started to create some ideas. And my brother established Transport Treasury, and I could see the exciting things that he was doing there. And a couple of years ago, I had a coffee with a Taiwanese railway enthusiast. And from that kind of conversation, just a couple of months later, in early 2024, we put together a book proposal and then started working on the book. And the thing I should say about my co-author, Wang Xiang, is that what he brings into the book is oral histories. So we have my photographs from the 1990s, and what he's been doing is interviewing hundreds of retired railway workers.
Wow.
Some of them in their 90s, some even over 100 years old. So in the book, we try and have that combination, the life stories or human stories of the retired railway workers plus the photographs. And we try and kind of paint a picture of a changing railway landscape, because in the 1990s, and that was the thing I really wanted to capture in the photographs, was the way that this railway system was rapidly going into decline. And every year, one or two sugar mills would close. So currently, there's very little left. Mm. Currently, there's only 15 kilometers of sugarcane railway operating.
Wow, that's such a crash, isn't it, from 3,000?
Down from 3,000 to 15 kilometers. There are a number of sugarcane tourist lines. And they probably, if you add them all up into about 5 sugar mills, it's something like maybe less than 30 kilometers of tourist lines still running. But there's so much more interest today in Taiwan. So when the book came out in December 2025, we did 5 book talks in Taiwan. And it was probably the best experience in my academic life.
Wow.
The audiences, the events were packed. We sold out all the books. There were people crying in the audience because it kind of touched upon their kind of often their childhood experiences. Because the railways network was so dense, if you lived in southern and central Taiwan, this is really part of your life. Mm. The sound, the smell of these trains. So everyone had a story to tell if they lived in that region of Taiwan. So I think that's one of the reasons why the book really was such a hit in Taiwan.
Now, unfortunately, we have to end it there, but I want to ask you, please, Daphnis, if you can tell us the name of your book so that people listening can go and find it for themselves.
So the book's name is The Twilight Years of Taiwan's Sugar Railways, the world's most extraordinary industrial railway. And it's published with Transport Treasury.
Yes, you can find it at transporttreasury.com or presumably search online for Professor Daphnis Feld. Thank you so much for joining us and enlightening us today. And anyone interested in industrial history, you will find this book an absolute delight. Thanks for being there.
Yes, I really enjoyed this conversation, going from my kind of childhood train spotting to the publication of my first railway book.
Oh, brilliant. Good man. Thank you so much. Join us again next time for more on The Catchcast.